Blog Talk Radio.
Live from Hollywood, it's rated LGBT Radio, starring your host, Rob Watson!
Good evening, good evening, wherever you are listening to us over the web, from the East Coast, from the West Coast, from out of the country, we welcome you. You are listening to Rated LGBT Radio here on our regular spot on Thursday evenings. And tonight, as we usually do, we have a really great show lined up for you with intriguing guests, or in this case, an intriguing guest. Brody Levesque will be doing co-host duties with me tonight. Brody, of course, is a renowned journalist, and he will be in just a few minutes also giving us some exclusive news updates. Our guest for tonight will be Nathan Mansky. Nathan is the director behind a project called I'm From Driftwood. And that project is probably one that you're aware of, even if you don't know that you're aware of it. Throughout many of our battles over the past few years for equality and for people to understand the plights of LGBTQ people, different videos have come online and gone through social media of individuals just telling their stories. And oftentimes, these stories were very compelling and intriguing and unique. And most of the time, the ones that really hooked you were the ones from I'm From Driftwood. And so tonight, we're going to take you behind the scenes on how that all came about and the different stories and its impact from Nathan Mansky. And we're really looking forward to that conversation. Right now, I want to welcome to the show newsman Brody Levesque. Brody, good evening. What's been going on?
Good evening, and good evening to all of our listeners. Right off the top, we've had the Kavanaugh hearings continue to be a circus in Washington. Dr. Ford has now agreed to testify later on in the week as opposed to Monday, although the White House is still saying that it is not necessary to have the FBI do an investigation. So we're kind of keeping an eye on that. Senate Republicans, of course, are pushing very hard to get Kavanaugh confirmed. The White House seems to feel that they should be able to do it, but at this point, it's just become a round and round, which is typical of Washington. While I'm mentioning Washington, I am going to give a shout out to some of our listeners at the United States Marine Corps Barrack at 8th and I, and they get a big, huge prop and well done and hoorah from me. There was a quick moving fire that could have gotten very tragic Wednesday afternoon in a building that's housing over 190 senior citizens. The Marines from the barracks didn't even think twice. They went in the building. They helped DC Fire get the folks out. Marine Captain Trey Gregory noted that these are our neighbors. They needed help, and we had to act. So props to the kids at 8th and I, and again, well done. While I'm giving shout-outs, I'm going to give a shout-out to a young man I'm acquainted with. Shen Lim is an illusionist and magician. And he was the season 13 winner of America's Got Talent. So, Shen, if you're listening tonight, congratulations and well done. This week, of course, today is the 7th anniversary of the actual end of Don't Ask, Don't Tell, the policy against service by gay and lesbian folks in the U.S. military that was implemented by the Clinton administration and then was repealed by the Obama administration. And today, of course, marks the 7th anniversary. Ironically, at the same time, earlier this week, a U.S. District Judge in California, U.S. District Court Judge Jesus G. Burnell, issued a ruling on Tuesday which denied the Department of Justice's request to lift the preliminary injunction that he had issued last December, halting President Trump's attempt to ban military service by trans individuals. Now, this was the fourth of a series of nationwide preliminary injunctions in U.S. District Courts in Maryland, Washington, the District of Columbia. And at this point, none of the bans are going to be removed. So the Justice Department is basically stymied, and the Trump administration is just going to have to continue to allow trans military service. Unfortunately, in Texas, though, we have another situation. We've had 27 young trans individuals murdered this year so far. In Webb County, Texas, which is on the border with Mexico, and its county seat is Laredo, the Webb County, Texas Sheriff's Office has identified the third victim of U.S. Border Patrol supervisory agent and accused serial killer David Juan Ortiz as Nikki Janelle Enriquez. Ms. Enriquez, who's 28 or was 28 years old, was found dead in a ditch alongside Interstate 35 near mile marker 15 in rural Webb County, outside of Laredo. There is a fourth victim who has not been identified, pending notification of the family. Ortiz was a 10-year Border Patrol veteran agent. He was arrested Saturday. A spokesperson for Webb County, Texas District Attorney Isidro Chilo Alain told the Los Angeles Plate on Monday that Ortiz, 35, had confessed to killing the four women between September 3rd and September 15th. And that's kind of a roundtable for the news. Obviously, there's a lot of other things going on, but I think I'd just rather talk to our guest, Rob.
Yeah, well, thank you, Brody, and thank you for the update on those stories. And yeah, I like the specific spotlight that you you bring to us each week, and it's valuable because they all get lost in the noise of all, as to your point, the other things going on out there. And so anyway, very, very grateful for that. So without further ado, I want to bring on our guest, Nathan Mansky, and the talk about the incredible program. Nathan, welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
Well, it's great to have you, an honor to speak to you. So tell us, what were you doing before I'm From Driftwood, and what was the impetus to come up with the idea for that program?
That actually is many things in my life now that makes me think of a story. Before I'm From Driftwood, I was working in advertising. I was a copywriter. I had gone to the University of Texas in Austin, which is nearby Driftwood, where I grew up, and got my advertising degree and graduated in 2003, and then moved to New York that fall. So in just a couple weeks, I'll be celebrating my 15-year anniversary in New York. And I moved here and got a job in advertising and moved around and was working my way up in my career. And I was a copywriter, so I was, you know, writing ads and doing creative work in advertising. And I finally got this job that, you know, I wasn't a junior anymore, so I was, you know, finally getting paid pretty well. And I had great clients. I got to travel around the world for these film shoots, you know. And I'm doing air quotes that you can't see, but I had it all, you know, in terms of what I thought of my trajectory for my career and what I wanted in life. And it wasn't until I had it all that I realized what I didn't have. And I was home for the holidays one year, and you know, I told my mom, or she was like, "How's the new job?" And I told her all the things that I just told you. You know, I was like, "Oh, it's great." You know, everything that I just told you. And she is moms, or at least my mom does pretty well. She saw through it all and was like, "Well, how is it really?" And I was like, "Oh, right. Well, I work really hard. And at the end of the day, I don't know the purpose of what I'm doing. I don't know, like, who cares, you know, who cares about what I do?" And, and I never hated going to work, which was really telling of how important purpose is, because I never hated it. You know, of course, I hated waking up early. I hated working late. I hated the basic things about working, but I enjoyed the work that I did and the people I worked with. So I was very fortunate in that regard. And this was in 2008 when I was kind of going through this thought process. And this was when President Obama or Senator Obama at the time was running. And, you know, I volunteered for him, and I was kind of, this fire within me was starting to be lit. And obviously he won, but the same night Prop 8 passed. So I got, you know, really upset about that. And I'm going to, I'm sorry if I'm going off this whole tangent about my whole life before I'm from Driftwood, but
no,
a little background is
this is what we
I
want to hear.
Okay, great. I'm from Texas, and I figured it out 1 year, and I kind of forgot. But I think before President Obama, I had a George Bush and some executive level in my life for every year of my life, except I think it was 2 or 4 years. So that means, you know, George Herbert Walker Bush was vice president for 8 years, and he was president for 4 years, and then George W. Bush was governor for, you know, in my state for however many years, and then he was president for 8 years. Like, George Bushes were in my life, my whole life. So Barack Obama to me, and I know he was for a lot of people, was all about hope and change, but to me, it was one of the first times in my life that I did not have a George Bush hovering over me, and you know, it just was this bright light that I was just like, oh my God. And I never for a second thought that, you know, my first election where I could vote was Bush versus Gore. So I was very quickly disenfranchised and felt, you know, like, ugh, what a bummer. Like, you know, we'll never win, you know? So I had a very difficult entry into the political world. So anyway, so that's where I was. So 2008, you know, throw all that in one big bucket, and that's what I was going through in 2008. You know, I was ready to find my purpose. Prop 8 passed. Obama won the election. It was a real, like, moment in my life that I can look back to that transformed my whole trajectory. And now I'm getting to I'm from Driftwood. Also, what happened in 2008 was the film Milk was released. And I went and saw that in theaters, and was incredibly moved by it. I had seen the documentary, I think it was called The Life and Times of Harvey Milk, you know, a few weeks or a couple months before the film. And the film just really, you know, just it taught me more about Harvey Milk, and he quickly became one of my role models and heroes. And the morning after watching that film, I was thinking about Harvey Milk, and for some reason this photograph of him popped in my head, and it's him in the San Francisco Pride March, and he's sitting on the hood of a car in the Pride March, and he's holding this big sign that read, "I'm from Woodmere, New York." And it just, you know, I just kept thinking of that photo over and over again and what it meant. And finally it hit me that, like, I don't know where Woodmere is. I don't even know what that sign means. I was like, Harvey Milk is from San Francisco, you know, but here the sign is saying that he's not from San Francisco. He's from this town that I have never heard of in my life. And it just dawned on me that, you know, here I am in Brooklyn, New York, but I'm not from Brooklyn. I'm from Driftwood, Texas. And what that meant to me right away was how much that would have meant to me growing up gay in Driftwood, Texas, that message of you're not alone. And so I immediately wanted, had this idea of collecting stories and sharing them with people to help them realize that no matter where they are, that they're not alone. And, you know, gay people aren't just in these big gay meccas like New York and San Francisco. We're everywhere, whether you realize it or not. And no matter what you're going through, you're not alone. And I wanted to get that point out there through storytelling. And it really just hit me like a lightning bolt. All that whole idea, I didn't have a name for it. I didn't know how I was going to do it. I originally wanted it to be a book, not a website. I didn't have a lot, but I knew that I wanted to collect stories for that reason. And here's the really, you know, eerie or amazing part is, so I saw Milk on a Wednesday, thought of the idea Thursday morning, but I was still at my job, you know, working hard and long hours in my advertising job. And on Friday, the day after thinking of the idea, I went into my job and I was laid off. And they laid off about 25% of the company. This is December 2008, the height of the recession. And I suddenly found myself with, you know, a purpose, a lot of passion and energy, and this, you know, eruption of fire within me to do something. And now, you know, on top of all that, a whole lot of free time. So that was so there you go. That was a very long answer to your question about what I did before.
That was amazing, and you covered the next question about where did the title "I'm from Driftwood" come from. So no, excellent, Brody.
Yeah, there. You know, I actually the title, it wasn't. I had a long list of titles of what to call it, and I have, you know, working in advertising, I have a lot of creative friends, and I actually sent them a list. I was like, "What do you guys think?" And I always try to give credit, because "I'm from Driftwood" is the result of so many volunteers and helpers and people who guided me along the way. And one of my friends said it was really, I almost called it "I'm from Woodmere," you know, really giving it to credit to Harvey Milk in that photo. And one of my friends said, like, let that be your inspiration, but look at it as passing a baton. And, you know, Driftwood has so many meanings, and, you know, people don't even, and they were so right. So it was with a little pushing from some friends that I called it "I'm from Driftwood," and I'm so glad I did, because so many people think, because Driftwood means something in itself, and people think that they don't know that it's the name of the town that I'm from. They think that I just named it that because Driftwood is drifting at sea and lost, and, you know, that's what it feels like to be closeted and gay, and, you know, people kind of create their own meanings of what "I'm from Driftwood" means, which I love that about it. And, you know, it's always a funny moment when, you know, if I meet people randomly, and whether it's at a work-related event or I just meet somebody at a bar and tell them about "I'm from Driftwood," they'll end up asking me, like, so where are you from? And I, you know, of course, laugh, and I'm like, well, I'm from Driftwood, Texas. And they're like, oh, it actually is a town. And I was like, yeah. So, yeah, that's where the obviously where the name comes from. But it wasn't as simple as being like, I guess I'll call it "I'm from Driftwood."
I'm going to pick up a little bit of the thread of that story. Driftwood, according to Webster's, is a noun, and it's pieces of wood that are floating on the sea or have been washed ashore. So I think if we're going to kind of make a comparison to the LGBTQI community, Nathan, that one's actually fairly apt. In late 2009, I was contacted by a couple of friends of mine who were bloggers, Joe Jervis, who runs the incredibly popular blog Joe My God, and Kenneth in the 212, which is a New York City-based blog. And they were all excited about this new website that was collecting oral stories and all these cool things. And at the time, I was still transitioning from Reuters to LGBTQ Nation magazine as the Washington bureau chief. And I had a little blog I was running that my personal assistant and I had set up called Brody's Notes and Scribbles. And we had these cool little buttons. And so we did kind of a staff selection of the things that we thought were really pretty good. And I went and looked at "I'm from Driftwood," and I loved it. As a journalist, as a historian, I was fascinated with what Nate was doing. And so one of the buttons, and if you go to Brody's Notes and Scribbles, even though the site hasn't been updated since 2014, on the right-hand column in the buttons, "I'm from Driftwood" is still there. And believe it or not, I just checked it. It's still an active link and goes straight to the site. So I've been a fan of Nathan since 2009. And in full transparency, anytime I know he's going to be traveling to a city, I have a tendency to dive into my Rolodex of people and start recommending them. It's like I'll call Nate up and go, hey, you really need to talk to these people. Nate, it's been a minute. I mean, since 2009, we've actually gotten to know each other. Tell us a little bit about the process that you started with early on, and then compare it to the process that you and your, well, for all intents and purposes, director of photography now do, which is actually probably a little bit more refined and certainly more technologically advanced.
Yeah, it's funny. That's a really good question, because I wish more than anything, you know, a lot of questions go around, like, if you could tell your younger self one thing, or a lot of time travel of what you could say or do for your younger self. And I've learned so much in the past 9 years. I look back and I'm like, oh my God, like, I can't believe no one noticed how I didn't know anything. And because now we have learned and progressed so much in the process of how we collect the stories, how we train people to tell a story, how we film and edit. And, you know, looking back, all we knew is that we wanted the stories that we collect to be stories, and to differentiate between what a story is and a journal entry or talking to a video about something. And I always knew that I wanted it to be a story, but I couldn't really articulate or know how to tell people what a story is. So we used to just find somebody who's interested, tell them loosely what we do, and we would just go meet them and be like, okay, you know, we want any story from your life involving you being LGBT, you know, and tell us a story. And I wouldn't hear or know what their story was going to be about until the camera's rolling. And, you know, there was some benefit to that, but it was just like winging it, you know. And since then, about 4 years ago, we refined it quite a bit. So it used to be one camera, a microphone, and now we use two cameras. We have lights and a microphone. But beforehand, we've developed a storyteller guide, and we send it to people, and they kind of browse through it. It helps them think of stories. So there's some story mining exercises that they have. And we put this together with somebody who has worked with a moth, and he's a professional storyteller. His name is David Crabb. And he's incredible, also from Texas. So he was incredible to work with. And so we work with people with this storyteller guide, a couple different ideas, and then we have a phone call with them to kind of hear the outline of their story. It's really important for us that the stories don't feel performed or rehearsed. We want it to feel raw and as if somebody just saw you on the street and was like, oh my God, let me tell you this story that just happened. You know, we don't want it to feel, you know, because really the what it boils down to, and the purpose of I'm from Driftwood, is to connect with people. And if you feel like you're being performed to, you kind of have this disconnect. And we really put that into everything that we do. So we always try to film people in their own environment, whether that's their apartment, their bedroom, their living room, or a friend's apartment. We, you know, we never film on a stage or in a studio. We really want it to feel like you're there with them, and as if you're in their living room. And, you know, we have all these words that we use behind the scenes, like, you know, what's the feeling of I'm from Driftwood? And it needs to be like, you know, like, come on in, kick your feet up, get comfortable, you know, and let's chat and tell a story. So we put that into everything that we do, and even our events that we have. We just want people to feel relaxed, calm, comfortable, and also because that's how that results in better stories. You know, if you're nervous and freaking out about something, you're not going to, you know, you're not going to tell a great story. But if you're relaxed and, you know, have a glass of wine, we don't encourage our storytellers to drink before they share their stories. But, you know, that vibe and that feeling and of, you know, relaxing and just sharing an important story. So yeah, that's the, you know, and in a way, we've kind of given ourselves a lot more work by doing it that way. But I feel like the stories have improved a lot as a result of that.
Nate, what are a few that, like, absolutely blew you away as you were watching and filming that took you by surprise, affected you deeply? What are a few of the standouts?
I would say it's hard for me to pinpoint one exactly, especially because the last several years we've known what the stories are beforehand. But looking back, what I think, and it's not about a specific story, but just how different, because the only prompt that we give people is to share a story that's meaningful to them. And And a lot of people are, you know, him and Hall, and they're like, oh, that's not direction. Like, give me, what kind of story do you want? And I'm like, I don't know your life. I don't know what's meaningful to you. I don't know if you had this amazing relationship. I don't, you know, so I didn't want to lead people down a certain path if it didn't lead to their best or most meaningful story. So the thing that surprised me the most is how varied and diverse these meaningful stories are to each person. So as a result of that direction of just saying, give us a story that's meaningful to you, we would get, you know, 1 week we would have this incredible love story. The next week we would have this traumatic story about like some workplace discrimination, you know, and emotions are, you know, you could either be really sad about something or really in love or really angry, but anything that kind of incites this, a lot of emotion, that's what people come to us with these stories. So I think overall what surprised me was how diverse the topics and themes and what people decide to share. Because it's always a choice of what story they want to share. And actually, the past 2 weeks, I'll tell you, yesterday we published a story, and it was about a man who experienced statutory rape when he was a teenager. So very heavy story, you know, very, very serious in tone, and he's doing great now, but, you know, a very sort of traumatic story. Last Wednesday was this guy who came out to his kids as a drag queen. So it's like, you know, they're both very meaningful to them, but they're on totally different ends of the spectrum. But you can see how, you know, this one has kids and it was important for the kids to know that he does drag in his spare time. So meaningful, very lighthearted, very funny. And then, you know, 7 days later, we have a story about statutory rape that is also, you know, important and meaningful, but just on the different ends of the spectrum. So I guess that would overall, that is what is most surprising. And it happens every week. Like, it's very rare that we have, even if it's the same theme, it's just everyone's stories are so unique. And it's just, I love it. I feel so grateful and lucky that I just get to like listen to stories for a living. And you know, so yeah, I don't know if that was if you wanted a specific example, but you know, that was that overall is probably the big takeaway that I've seen from story to story.
Nate, it was. Nate, I'm going to take you back to 2010, and I'm going to take you back to a really unfortunate fall that we had in 2010. As you know, 7 years ago, young Jamie Rotemeier killed himself in Buffalo, New York. We had Tyler Clemente, who unfortunately ended his life off the GW Bridge there between Jersey and Manhattan. And that, of course, became the genesis for what became the It Gets Better project and just a rash of video reaffirmation and types of stories. The difference, I think, in making a difference in what you do and what that was and some of the other things that are going on. But let's talk about I'm From Driftwood making a difference, because the context of your stories and how they present themselves as part of, you know, people's lives. And I'm looking back at 2010 and that horrible, horrible fall and wondering, you know, these stories are so critical because they're just not there to record a moment. They really are there to make a difference. Talk to me a little bit about that, making a difference.
Yeah, I feel like It Gets Better was just incredibly perfectly successful because it was a laser-focused mission of we want everyone to know that it gets better. You know, it was just this perfect, you know, and it took off and reached this, you know, atmospheric level of, you know, success. And everyone now knows the phrase, it gets better. What we feel like we are providing is more like what you're not alone. And that message says is that no matter what you're going through, you're not the only one. And but also more than that, it says, if you are experiencing, you can learn from these stories. So, you know, some research about 2 years ago that we sent out a survey to I Can Driftwood followers and subscribers and asked them, you know, how they feel after watching these stories. And we knew that it was a friendly audience, so we were going to get some good numbers. So what we were really looking at was the differences. So, you know, let's say 90% said they become more accepting of the LGBTQ community after watching our stories. That's kind of what we expected. But then what was surprising was there was a 97% increase in understanding of the community. And I was like, why? This is your own community. What do you mean you understand it more? You know, and then as we kind of dug into the research a little bit, we realized that there's so much about our community that we don't know ourselves. You look at the transgender community, and maybe gay men don't know enough about the transgender community. And, you know, what that says to us is that we need to make sure that our stories are as diverse and representative of our community as possible. Because what we learned from the survey is that we are learning so much about ourselves. And what that can do is, you know, that gets to the core or gets to the heart of people to let them know that they're not alone through these stories. And I think that there's just that message can't be understated of not only you're not alone, but people in your community are different and you can learn about them. I think those go hand in hand.
That's great. One thing that on my other show out in Santa Cruz, my co-host, Bashy Eldon, and I talk about a lot of the movies that are out and the ones that have come out in recent years, a lot of them depicting coming out, and it's always sort of a theme of coming out, meeting, discrimination or lack of approval and sort of fighting through, and everything is sort of on a, you know, sort of a two-dimensional arc. And one of the things that I think is so significant about I'm From Driftwood is that the stories are not, you know, in these cute little, you know, generalized buckets. They're, to your point, they're individuals and real lives, and the stories themselves may not be even about similar things necessarily, but they are all in a tapestry of the, you know, the broader LGBTQ experience. And, Bash has made the observation that we keep seeing this, you know, ooh, we're coming out, you know, oh, we find, you know, the end of the movie, we kind of accept ourselves and move on. And, you know, kind of a desire on the part of screenwriters to really go beyond that and start writing characters that are already out, that are already living their lives and already having experiences. From your perspective of what you've seen on the productions you've done, what storylines do you wish Hollywood would pick up and run with?
All of them. You know, I'm a big superhero fan. I have like X-Men, you know, was a huge part of my life when I was a teenager. And I promise I have a point to this, but so I view the world through the lens of superhero, you know, fandom a lot. And I feel like the films that you're talking about and the TV shows of, like, let's say the 90s to, you know, I would say Bareback Mountain kind of like was the peak of what I consider the queer community's origin story. You know, and after a while, back to the superhero thing, it's like, we don't need more origin stories. Like, come on, like, we get it. They're superheroes. Let's just see what they do. Like, what's next? Like, we know superheroes exist. What are they doing next? What are they doing now? We don't need another Spider-Man origin story. The same could be said about, you know, the queer community. We know that, you know, there are gay cowboys. We know that there are gay everyone, that the queer community exists. And, you know, but who are we? What are our lives like? You know, it doesn't have to be every villain doesn't have to be the closet. You know, where do we go next? And, you know, every queer person knows the answer. It's our lives. And so what I think is interesting is that's, I think it's happening, you know, and I think unfortunately, a lot of times the, you know, gay men and lesbians move forward at a faster pace than people who are gender nonconforming or transgender or fluid. And you know, so I, you know, I feel like gays and lesbians got ahead, and then, you know, the transgender community is having this moment, and, you know, but it's, it feels like it's catching up, but soon it's like, okay, what is beyond the we exist story, and we're here, and we're here, we're queer, we're out, whatever. You know, so, it, and I think the next step is just including that. Oh, here's a perfect way to combine superhero movies and the queer community. In Deadpool 2, which came out this year, there was a queer character. They're lesbians in the film, and the actress who played the one of the lesbian characters in the film is queer in real life. And she told the director, she was like, queer in the movie, just have her be queer. Don't make it a thing. Don't have Deadpool
right
be like, you're queer, cool, I'm okay, you know, just don't make it about her being queer, just let her live her life as a queer person. And they did it, and it was beautiful, and it was awesome, and it was just right. And that is what, you know, that's the sequel to the queer community and media, is us just existing and being in these films without it being a big deal. And, you know, oh yeah, this is my girlfriend. Like, that's it. And, you know, that's, there is a little danger in that, because we do have different needs and different lives and different experiences. So it's not about being just like straight people, but it's about, you know, adding to these, revealing and showing these complexities that we have without it being about coming out.
Yeah, no, absolutely. It's just, even recently, though, we had, you know, Love, Simon and Call Me By Your Name, both, you know, wonderful movies, but they were, again, the same, you know, oops, we're coming out, oops, we're coming out, you know. And I love what you're saying, though, that I agree with. And I would love to see some dramatic depictions of some of the people, you know, some of the story like that you have told through I'm From Driftwood, that are just, you know, it's not like, oh, big deal, I'm gay, but it's, this is what the life is like, you know. And, you know, not focusing on, you know, oh, it's an LGBTQ person, but this is an experience. This is a human experience. So, Brody?
Yeah, well, picking up on that, and Rob's got a good point, Nate. Let me ask you this. In the nearly 40 years of being a journalist, I spent an incredible amount of time interviewing people and talking to people. And one of the most important aspects, I think, as far as my profession goes, is trying to get the person comfortable enough so that they're not self-aware and it doesn't become a cliché-ish thing. For you as the executive producer and for your director of photography and for your production staff, how do you work with these folks as you're getting these stories and you're doing your documentary films without that happening, without the cliche moment or the, you know, as you just put it, and Rob so eloquently stated, the coming out thing and the this thing. I mean, how do we move that and transition that? More importantly, how do you transition that as you're filming these segments?
You know, I have a strength and which is also a weakness whenever I get these stories. And the strength is that by doing it the way that we do it, we make sure that every single story follows a story arc. The weakness is because I become a little bit robotic in getting these stories. Whenever I first hear the story on the phone or hear what the story is going to be about, and it's happened naturally now, which, you know, I don't know, maybe I'm emotionless, but the way I listen to it is I'm listening for, okay, where's the setting? Is a viewer going to be in their shoes? You know? So then I'll ask a question like, okay, wait, how old were you and where were you? You know? So I'm just focused on, you know, I see this arc in my mind, and if every single part of that arc is not filled in by the end of the phone call, I still am asking more questions. So and that sounds so bland and, like I said, emotionless, but I think by me looking at it that way, almost as a machine, that I remove, you know, so I'm not on the phone being like, oh my God, like, really? You know, because then that might feed into their like, yeah, then this, and, you know, it becomes this like therapy session. But instead, I just ask questions that fill in the blanks of a complete story. And I think, I hope at least, that the storyteller picks up on that a little bit, to where they're not like, oh, my story isn't so crazy. I can actually tell him whatever I want. And, you know, he's not reacting like, what? You know? And I feel like they and this is, again, a hope. I haven't asked them how it is. But I think by them feeling that I'm so neutral about it all, that they do end up opening up. And I think that's a little bit of a, you know, maybe that's what therapists do. You know, they nod a lot and take notes, and they try not to say too much. So maybe there's something to that, but it kind of happened naturally that way. And the more refined we got as we got to collecting more stories, I feel like, you know, and who knows, maybe the storytellers all leave and talk behind my back about how cold and emotionless I am. But I hope that helps them feel like they can open up a little bit to me by me staying neutral for them.
How do you know when you have the aha moment? I can tell you as a journalist, because as I'm listening, there'll be something that'll just stand out, and it'll be everything suddenly clicks and you get the aha. You're doing the pre-interview and the kind of the warm-up and everything, which admittedly I actually do for the show as the producer. I spent a lot of time on the phone with our guests. I didn't have to do that with you because you're a friend and I've known you for so long, but I do that frequently. You know, I'll do the warm-up, not unlike what you do, but what is it that gives you that aha moment, Nate? You know what? This is going to be one of those stories.
It's different. I'll give you an example. It's different for everyone, but and it's funny that you describe it that way, because it's definitely a feeling, and I wouldn't be able to teach it to anyone. It's just like, when you feel like you've got it, you've got it. And, you know, just recently backing up a little bit, we have two programs that we do ongoing. One is our weekly video story program. So every Wednesday we publish a new video story. We also have a separate program called What Was It Like? And it's stories specifically of LGBTQ elders. And the difference is, for our weekly video stories, we get one story from their life. For What Was It Like? Because they're older and they have so many more stories to share, we help them figure out 6 to 8 individual stories from their life to share. And we film and edit them individually. So it's, you know, they're all standalone stories. And the reason we do that is because we don't think that anyone is going to watch an hour-long video on YouTube. But we also want to make sure that our elders have time to share their full life and experiences that are so important. So that said, about 2 weeks ago, I spent about 2 hours with a What Was It Like storyteller to kind of help him go through his life, basically, and pick out the story that he wants to share. And this is so common. They're like, I don't know, this is my life, you know, and I'm trying to take notes and separate them into individual stories. And I'm like, okay, maybe, you know, we have 4 buckets here. You know, we'll have to refine them. And then I got home and kind of went over my notes and separated the stories and worked with it a little bit. And I emailed them and said, can we hop on a call to talk about potential more stories? And I coached him a little more. On the phone call, he was like, oh, after you left, I thought about this time that there was a Thanksgiving in San Francisco in 1970. And I'm like, oh my God, like, that was all I needed to hear. And I was like, okay, he's got it. He got it. Like, before, it was him just talking about things loosely, but right, you could tell it in his voice, his mannerisms, his excitement. Like, he was just like a student acing the test, where he was saying dates, locations, characters, there was dialogue. And I never even told him that that's what we're looking for. It was just, he got it. So once I knew that, I was like, we're good. We're going to set up a time to come with the cameras and get your stories. So that's how I know when people get what a story is. And then, you know, once I, there's one thing that we look for in every story, which is a change moment, whether it was a cute love story or a traumatic story from childhood. you know, I'm always looking for something that in my mind says, and that was when everything changed, you know, something that, that allows the person to look back and be like, here is why I do what I do now. And I try not to tell the storyteller that, cause I don't want it to feel forced or, you know, heaven forbid they actually say, and that's when everything changed, you know, but, there needs to be some sort of change or growth or, you know, shift in direction in their life or who they are, or what they do, for it to be a story. And sometimes I don't even think too hard about it. You can just kind of feel it. So that's kind of how it is. It's very, I would say it's unscientific. It's, you know, Brody, I'm sure it's the same with you on a phone call. Like you can kind of feel if people got it or not. Mm-hmm. And that sounds so, you know, like hippie kind of like, I don't know. It's just a vibe, but it's just a vibe.
Yeah. Yeah.
We call
Nathan. Nathan, I wanted to ask you, you brought up what was it like, and I wanted to actually dig into that a little deeper, and I'm going to try not to answer my own question here, but I just feel like that production and that project is so important, especially now where we have people coming of age who did not experience a lot of the kind of the hardcore world that we have emerged from. And with this, a little bit of an expectancy, good or bad, of things to just be done, you know, appropriately now without any tolerance for a world perspective where it was a revelation to treat people with equality and fairness. It was not just an easy given. But what was your impetus in creating this part of the program, and what impact do you hope it has?
So the creation of What Was It Like was very need-based. And so we always try to make sure our stories represent, you know, the full spectrum of the community and the diversity, whether it's, you know, age or race or gender, and background. So we would, you know, seek out people who are older, and we would do what we normally do, help them figure out a single story from their life. And, you know, we'd show up and film, and as they were sharing their story, they would, adding more and more to their story. And I'd have to kind of like rein them in and be like, okay, let's just focus on this one story. You know, so let's get back to this dinner that you had with your former lover, you know, well, then what happened? And then they would be like, well, you know, I actually met him when I was 17, and here's what happened at school when I met him. And I was like, okay, wait, we got to, you know, it was like reining them in a little bit. And so then they would tell us a whole lot more than that one story, than we agreed upon filming. And we would go away, we would edit it and publish it to be, you know, the typical 4 to 6 minute sweet spot of our stories. And we publish it, and I would send them the link, and it never failed. They would write back, you know, something nice like, oh, I love how you edited it. It's great. Thank you. But I told you so much more. What about this and this and this? And, you know, here I was being the jerk who was like, you know, well, it's, you know, it's not part of the story, you know, and it didn't feel right. It didn't feel like I was respecting their stories and what's important to them. And it just was always, I always cringed a little bit and felt bad. And I was like, why fight this? Like, why not like roll with it and let them tell more stories and just figure out how to make do with that. And so that was where so we wanted to make sure that we got everything we wanted, which is make sure people watch the stories. So it needs to be short, but make sure they're all stories. So, you know, that's why we ended up with this format of collecting multiple stories, but also making them all individual 4 to 7 minute, you know, video stories. So, and it's, you know, it immediately stopped the concerns and complaints that we were getting about, you know, where's this story and this story. And, you know, so it, you know, really, and also that's the need you know, kind of the dry answer. But one, the way I look at the elder LGBTQ community is there's no other generation, there never has been, there never will be, who has seen more change in their life than, let's say, a 70, 80-year-old queer person right now. They had been arrested for being gay. They have been castrated, thrown in jail. They have been killed. And now they can get married. They can serve in the military. They have seen the full, and obviously we have ways to go, but no one will, you know, I kind of feel like we're fine tuning things now and still, you know, and well, I hate saying that actually, but there's huge issues with, you know, homeless youth and especially trans women of color and the needs that they have that don't seem to be getting better. But the elders have seen such huge change, and I want to like take a photo of that. Like, and you know, we've already lost so many of them in the 80s and 90s to AIDS. There's already a huge percentage of that generation missing, and what's left, I want to document it as quickly and as thoroughly and properly as possible. And I'm just like, wait, you know, like, let's come talk to us now before, you know, it sounds morbid, but before we lose even more. And it's, you know, my life, you know, people who are 50, their lives are so much different than people who are 70 and so much different than people whose lives are certainly, you know, 16, 17, 18. And, you know, in 50 years, the gap between the younger and older generation, the differences will still be great, but not as great as they are right now at this moment. And that gap is already closing. And I'm just, now that I'm talking about it, I want to like run out with my camera and just like start filming people. And it's, we're running out of time to collect their stories. So that's kind of the urgency and emotional connection to it that I have.
And the thing of it is, as a historian and as a journalist, my good friend Tom Brokaw, as you know, spent a lot of time documenting what he termed America's greatest generation. And, of course, these were the folks that fought the Second World War. They'd lived through the Depression. They fought the war. They saw the dawning of the atomic era. They saw the beginning to the end of Vietnam, the moonshot. It was just that whole uplifting and movement and things, and in many ways, what you said, Nate, just makes absolute sense and rings so true with me. I'm going to shift gears here for a second. We're in an era of Patreon and GoFundMe and Kickstarter, and you're traveling all over the country. And you know, what can folks do to help I'm From Driftwood? I know that you do the annual fundraisers there in New York, and unfortunately, sadly, I'm always out of town and never able to attend, but what can folks, you know, do to help contribute to keep the archives and your work that is so critically important continuing forward?
That's easy. There's two things. One is the easiest one and the one that most people cringe at, donate. We're a nonprofit. All donations are tax deductible. And that's, you just go to the website, imfromdriftwood.org, and there's a donate button on there. It costs money to produce the stories professionally. We archive all the raw footage at NYU here. We're traveling to get stories. We're, you know, expanding. We want to get into podcasts and other forms of media. So we're definitely growing and need all the support that we can get. And we also love volunteer services. We have so many ideas of what we want to do. So now I'm shifting into the other way. There are so many things that you can actually do. You can share your story. Go to the website, imfromdriftwood.org, click on contact, and just let me know if you want to share a story. If you're not in our area, we do travel quite a bit, and we're also trying to start training different production teams in different parts of the country. So if you're a videographer or producer in another part of the country outside of the New York area, let me know, and we can train you, and you know, you can collect stories wherever you are. But share your story. Like we travel a lot to Chicago and Boston and Philadelphia, and you know, we want to have a West Coast. I want to travel up and down the West Coast, and we're going to be in Seattle next Friday for a week collecting stories. So we're looking for storytellers right now in Seattle. Just get involved. This is all under the bucket of get involved. whether it's sharing a story, sharing stories on social media, just contact me. Let me know how you can help, and I promise we can find a way for you to help. Just yesterday, we met with a supporter who wants to do some like graphic animations for us for our videos, and like not on our top of list of urgent things that we need, but that I'd love to have some animation to open up our videos, and people like that, and it keeps us fresh and a little more edgy, and you know, so we need so much help doing things like producing, helping us find storytellers. So those are the two buckets. One is just a big old donation or small donation, whatever, because we're a nonprofit. The other one is just get involved in some way and email me through the contact form on the website of, you know, how you want to get involved, and, you know, just say hi and we'll figure something out.
And Nathan, we're running our time out here. Quickly, how do people watch the videos now? What is the best means for them to partake in what you've already produced?
You can just, all of our stories are freely available. Every single story that we've ever published, they're all on our website. I'm from driftwood.org, and they're all on there in chronological order. Or you can just go to our YouTube channel because they're all uploaded on our YouTube channel as well. And that's just youtube.com/I'm from Driftwood. Or you can just, you know, Google search I'm from Driftwood and it should pop up, or it will pop up. And that's it. We have about 520 video stories on that we've published. And if you want, you can scroll to the bottom of our page and there's a search bar. You can search by category like lesbian, gay, transgender, queer, ally. And there's also a search bar where you can type in, for example, Texas, and it'll pull up all the stories from Texas. So, you know, if you want to, you know, that's the whole point of this is to learn from these stories. So go jump on in and, you know, explore all our stories.
Fantastic. I want to thank you so much for coming on tonight. This has been fascinating on many levels. I'm encouraging our audience to go check out the 500-plus stories. I'm from Driftwood. You just heard how to find them. Very exciting, and I can't wait to see what you produce in the future. Brody, my co-host and producer and good friend and incredible journalist, I want to thank you for all of your work on tonight's show and all of them. I want to remind folks that if you liked what you heard tonight, don't go away. On Saturday night on www.ksco.com is Out in Santa Cruz, 7 p.m. Pacific Time, 10 p.m. Eastern Time. We will have more LGBT-related topics there. And as for us on Rated LGBT Radio, we will be back here, same bat time, same bat channel, with new and great information starting next week. I mean, we're here every week, and you can also find our backlog of incredible interviews online there as well. I want to thank you for listening. We don't take you for granted. Be safe, be smart, be wonderful, be fabulous. Thank you so much from the Rated LGBT team, and we will talk to you again next week.
You've been listening to Rated LGBT Radio.